Blog Talk Radio.
Africa, the center of the world. Latitude zero, longitude zero. Planned by the Creator. Sesanthropus was the first man found on the earth. That earth was the motherland. We know that without total understanding of what happened in the past, it would be difficult to relate to the future. We know that within the structure of the music, there should be a message, and the message should be truth. So now, we give you Africa, the center of the world.
Hey. Jabari, call in.
Okay, hold on.
Jabari, you there? Jabari. Jabari.
You
there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Can you hear? Okay.
I hear you. Can
you... Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system. 9739416057 is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Anthony, this is Haki. Call in, bro. Call Robert. Both of y'all call in. All right, I'm on. I'm on, okay? So call in. All right, bye. Jabari.
I'm here.
Jabari.
I'm here.
Okay, I'm seeing if...
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Hello?
I can hear you.
Okay.
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to see if Anthony, trying to get Anthony and... Hey, Anthony. Call Robert. Y'all call in. I'm on now. I got to let me in. All right, bye. Yeah, hey, Jabari?
Yeah, I'm here.
Jabari. Yeah,
I'm here.
It's going to be a few minutes. Let them call in, bro.
All right.
Let them call in and we can get started, bro. They decided to let me in, so they. I tell you, it's always something, man. So I guess we just apologize to the audience, you know, that we didn't get on start on time, but it's beyond our control. We ain't got no control over, you know, the game plan.
Okay.
All right. So at least it give us an hour and a half to do our thing. So, you know.
Yes. So, just to let you know, after after we make the apology, in lieu of doing the introduction, we're going to just go into it. Anthony wanted to speak about King, so I was going to have him speak about the true Martin Luther King, and that's the Hallmark version.
Yeah, well, yeah, we do it the way you want to do it, bro. You're running the program, so
no,
you do it the way
you
want.
So you don't get confused. So we're going to talk about Martin Luther King for a moment, and then the first article... we're going to do is the one about the 10,000 school students.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. Well, all right.
And then we're going to roll with about Flint, Michigan with the poison water.
Okay. All right. Well, you do the order that you want to do it, you know. Sorry that they...
Okay. Well, long as you got your info, so okay. All right.
Yeah, they screwed us up. Sorry, you know, so, yeah. Yeah, I'm just waiting for Anthony and Robert to get on. Oh, well, we got Robert. Robert, hold on one second. Robert, you there, right?
Yeah.
Robert, okay, and Anthony got you. Okay, Jabari, you
great.
Go ahead. Start, do your thing. We got him here. Go ahead.
Okay. Evening. We apologize for the delayed start, but we welcome you to tonight, Africa on the Move. And we're going to begin tonight's program with a discussion on who the true Martin Luther King Jr. is, and that's going to be led by Brother Anthony. Brother Anthony, are you there?
Yes, I am. Revolutionary greetings, everyone that's within the sound of my voice. My name is Anthony Williams. I'm an organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC. Our objective is Pan-Africanism, the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. What I want to say about Martin Luther King Jr. is that he was a hardworking, dedicated, committed revolutionary. And he was committed to the liberation of Africans and peoples worldwide from all manifestations of oppression and capitalism. And I would add that that the most important lesson he left for us was how to face our enemies without fear. Contrary to popular belief, it is not nonviolence. He made that a principle, and that was the biggest error of his career. But the most important lesson he left for us was how to face our enemies without fear.
Okay, thank you, Brother Anthony. And for the fellow panelists, did you all want to give any reflections on the life, the legacy, and the work of Martin Luther King Jr.? The floor is yours.
Well, I would like to say that he spoke truth to power, and that was critical. He taught us to not be afraid to speak truth to power. Thank you.
Anyone else have anything else to share?
No, I think everything was pretty much, summed up in terms of the two previous panelists. So I'll just go along with the statements that they made.
Indeed, he truly had a great legacy, and what we want our viewers to know most importantly is that you cannot fall victim to just believing in the Hallmark portrayals that you'll see on TV tomorrow that are a very revisionist piece of history. You need to do your research and find out who he was for yourself, and not let other people tell his story for him. And as we move on our program, we will go to our first discussion topic of the night. And the title of the topic is 10,000 NYC school students face airport-style security. It was written by Cecilia Reyes on behalf of Black Agenda Report. I ask Brother Haki to take the lead on this article.
Okay, I'm sorry. What was the name of that? Say the article again. I can't hear you. Say again.
10,000 NYC school students face airport-style security.
Oh, yeah. I think the thing about the article was extremely unfortunate was the fact that these kids who supposedly going to school to be educated are treated like common criminals. I think the implication being that, in fact, that they are common criminals. And I think one of the things I think is probably more problematic than anything, if, in fact, you know, you're teaching young people to trust one another, one of the most reprehensible things you can do is to not to trust the kids. And I think that lack of trust in terms of, you know, how the kids are treated has negative repercussions in terms of kids' own attitudes as they tend to be very suspicious toward others. I think that's really ironic in terms of what's going on. I think this notion that somehow because the kids live in poor neighborhoods or somehow impoverished, that somehow that equates to criminality, I think is fundamentally a problem. I think at some point people have to begin to recognize, you know, that particularly those in the African community or those in the Hispanic community or those in oppressed nationalities, have to come at some point begin to realize, you know, that this kind of treatment of their children, this kind of poor treatment of their children, you know, is something that needs to be addressed because of the repercussions that it has in terms of not only how the kids see themselves, but how they see other people in the community. So I think fundamentally is a real problem. I think it's something that the community itself has to address. And I'm hard-pressed to even understand why so many parents, so many professional people, quote-unquote professional people in the community actually go along with this kind of treatment of their children. So I think I'm extremely confused in terms of, you know, this kind of phenomenon.
Thank you. Brother Anthony, your response.
Yeah, I think a part of the problem is because a lot of children's parents are so busy working two or three jobs just to, maintain a sufficient income to sustain themselves, and they tend not to get involved and what happens in the schools, which was a major error, unfortunately, in my opinion. And I think this treatment of children as common criminals breeds a certain amount of distrust among them initially and among other people in the community. And it's a barrier to effective community organizing in the long run. And you know, and I think it's unfortunate that more Africans don't speak out against this sort of thing occurring.
Brother Robert, your response?
Yes, I'm not totally up on this subject. I want to say I grew up in spent some formative years in public housing, so I'm used to being marginalized and profiled, and the school systems, you know, have a way of profiling you and making you a second class citizen, more or less. Anyway, I'm not prepared for this. I'll hold off right now. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I am interested as I looked at this article, and I want my other panelists to chime in too, is what are the economic implications regarding this kind of security being in place? Can you imagine what kind of fee was spent to not only install this, but just to, you know, the electricity and other costs that may arise because of it, or even if it's malfunctioning, so you have maintenance. But yet they always say they don't have enough money to properly serve our school system. Now, tell me, what's going on with that contradiction?
I agree. The expenditures just in terms of security personnel and our police, I mean, it's enormous. One of the things is that I think as far as the system is concerned, one of the benefits of the system is to give us opportunity to promote this notion that, in fact, these kids are dangerous. And so, therefore, from a societal standpoint, from a standpoint of those in power who want to convey, you know, the very negative, you know, things about our children, I think for them it serves a purpose. So that kind of expenditure for them is not really important, because, more importantly, it gets the message out that somehow these kids are just dangerous. So I think for them, the question of economics is not even germane. I think in terms of, you know, for the community at large, I think one of the things is that when you kind of have these kind of expenditures for security, obviously it means there's no money for books, there's no money for computers, there's no money for labs, those kind of things that kids need in terms of being able to compete in the 21st century. So I think you're right. It is an irony. It is very contradictory to say on one hand that you don't have any money, but on the other hand that you have lots and lots of money in terms of security and of police. So I think you're absolutely correct. And I think that, but I think more importantly, the social implications in terms of how our kids are being, how they're being represented or how they're being portrayed throughout the community, I think is something that the community have to be very, very concerned about.
And just to let the listening audience know, the theme of tonight's program is Negligence, Nuance, and Numbers, a Critique of Capitalism. And what we see here is one of the examples that offers our critique, because in lieu of the priority being students' education, you have some type of ill-conceived notion that they're somehow a big threat, so you have professional-grade security that they have to deal with on a daily basis. That's a distraction as they make their way through classes, or if something did come up, just the different hazards that this creates. But before we move on to our next topic, does anybody else have any closing thoughts?
I do. I think the conditions in this society are such that when it comes to security, there's always resources available. But I think people lose sight of the fact that there are other essentials to life other than security, which is why the police unions are for maintaining this surveillance of our students, because it provides additional revenue for them, but it damages our community in the long run, as I said earlier.
And as we continue to our discussion of the negligence, the nuance, and the numbers, we move on to our next article entitled, Doctors Have Less Sympathetic Nonverbal Communication with Dying Black Patients. Now, what is going on when we live in society where one's pigmentation is determinant of what kind of medical care they're going to receive? I'll ask that Brother Moses takes the lead on this article.
Yes, I'm a little more familiar with the last three articles. This medical teams, I think they sent in some undercover, more or less, patients to get an idea of what the discrepancies were in terms of different people of color and the treatment of white people versus people of color. And it was found that there was less bedside empathy for people of color. And I think, you know, we live in a white minority rule system, basically, and this reflects, you know, the values and that are being perpetuated by the ruling class and permeates society. And this is just an example of it. Thank you.
Hey, Brother Hackey.
Yeah, I think one of the things when we talk about Africans and the medical establishment, African people have always been perceived as the other in terms of medical care. If we go all the way back to colonial times, one of the real ironies was that there was a instrument that was used to measure your lung capacity called a spirometer. And actually what it was used to do was to indicate just how much the capacity of lungs that African people were lacking. In other words, because the capacity for Africans to take in oxygen, it impacts on the brain. Of course, the implications of being that somehow African people were inferior simply because their lung capacity wasn't equal to, quote-unquote, white people's lung capacity. Now, here's the thing that we have to understand in terms of medicine, the evolution of human beings. Now, one of the things that when you talk about the capacity of lung capacity, the amount of oxygen you take in has nothing to do in terms of your ability to nourish your mind, in terms of your brain, in terms of its use of oxygen. It comes down to the environment. In a place where Africa was very, very hot and the air is very, very thin, the body is much more efficient in terms of utilizing the oxygen that it receives in terms of being able to nourish the brain. So therefore, this Western medicine attempt to portray Africans as somehow lacking in terms of lung capacity speaks to a perverse kind of racism that says that because African people don't process oxygen the same way white people take in oxygen, it means that their brain's not nourished, and so therefore their enslavement is necessary simply because they don't have the brain capacity. Also, we get into science in terms of just phrenology, where we talk about the size of the skull. There's been long-held position in Western medicine where the shape of your head determines your sense of morality. This is bizarre, coming from a people who enslave others, or people who subjugate others, or people who kill people, that you have the audacity to say that your head shape determines your morality. So this is, again, it's indicative of the kind of racism, the kind of venom that was spewed against African people. Now, it gets so absurd when you talk about, you know, African, you know, when you talk about medicine, African people. Back in colonial times, there was a medical term called dropsomania. Dropsomania was simple. It was the belief that the reason why African people attempted to escape slavery because there was something wrong with them genetically or something wrong with them mentally. So, in other words, if they were normal, they would stay on the plantation and allow themselves to be subjected to all kind of cruelty because that's the intelligent thing to do. But the mere fact that the African people attempted to escape slavery was indicative of the fact that something was wrong with them genetically and intellectually. So this is the way in terms of Western presentation when it comes to African people. So we understand the absurdity on the face of it. Even if you go back even further, if you go back to the Venus Hottentot, the Zulu sister, in which the British brought in, had in captivity, to talk about her buttocks and talk about her labia in terms of being, you know, overly, quote unquote, overly exaggerated, which not only speaks to the question in terms of beauty, but also speaks in terms of, again, the question in terms of morality. And that is ironic, too, because one of the things that we know in terms of studying colonial history is that one of the things that those white men in colonial times valued was a big butt on a woman. And one of the things they did was the white women had petticoats to give their behinds an exaggerated sense of being large. And so, therefore, you know, this whole notion that somehow Venus and Hottentot was somehow lacking in terms of beauty underscores just how the kind of racism that existed in society in terms of the unwillingness for white people to confront the beauty as it exists in African people. So, of course, we all know about Margaret Sanger in terms of eugenics, in terms of this whole notion that somehow, to a large extent, that one's color determined their fitness for society. So we understand this whole attempt to genetically just wipe out a whole group of people based upon the assumption that somehow they are genetically flawed from the very, very beginning. So this is something that's been peculiar throughout Western history when it comes to medicine. And, of course, finally I'm going to conclude with this, when we talk about the Tuskegee experiments. We all know about the Tuskegee experiments, but one of the things that I find particularly problematic when you talk about the Tuskegee experiments is that this was not only held at a African university, but actually two of the leading people who actually participated in the Tuskegee experiment were African people. One was Dr. Eugene Dibbles, and another one was a nurse. Her name was Eunice Rivers. And now the whole point was their participation was all about getting money. But the question in terms of the impact that the injustice inflicted upon the African community wasn't a concern of these two particular black folks. And so they participated with the white establishment in terms of making sure that these people were inflicted with spirochete or the so-called syphilis germ, and which was allowed to incubate, you know, in their bodies. And the saddest of it all is the fact that even after they found a cure with penicillin, those individuals who were subjected to the experiment weren't given the penicillin to treat the syphilis in their bodies, leaving these men to infect hundreds and hundreds of other people, you know, in the community. So this is pretty much sums it up in terms of Western medicine. And so I can understand the kind of implicit bias when it comes to some white doctors in terms of their interactions with African people. So I'm not surprised at all if you look at the history.
And before we go to Brother Anthony, I just want to say that speaks volumes about the lack of value that those in the 1% have for life outside of themselves and their family. Because it's clear, if you're willing to be cruel to someone who's in a dire situation in terms of their health capacity, it's no telling what you'll do to those who have a better sense of health that are in opposition to your agenda. But, Brother Anthony, would you please proceed with your commentary?
Certainly. I would concur with what's been said so far and would add that one of the points that Haki made about a couple of Africans being involved in the Tuskegee experiment that he alluded to, which victimized, poor African males, essentially, and their families, speaks to one of the major manifestations that capitalism manifests itself today, and that is neocolonialism. And that's the situation where you have, where the first line of oppressors look like the masses of the people, but really don't have their interests at heart. They think more like their oppressors in terms of taking advantage and exploiting African people, which I think is the root at why Africans have a certain degree of mistrust of medicine that they do, because they perceive as being treated differently because of their ethnicity and also their relationship to the means of production, which means they're not European and they're not wealthy. And unfortunately, in this society, that does have a big effect on the quality of medical care you receive, especially if you don't have any health insurance.
And I would like to add to the discussion, and Brother Haki, I'd like for you to respond, because you alluded to it earlier when you talked about the work of Margaret Sanger historically. Is, as we talk about disembiosis, why is it that those institutions that are pretty much genocide machines, the likes of Planned Parenthood, why is it that they're always in close proximity to the poor and people of color? You know, I find that to be a very interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, well, I think it's par for the course. I mean, the notion that somehow differences equate to inferiority makes sense, that those individuals who are perceived as different somehow you want to eradicate by any means necessary. And so therefore, if you have contraceptives which will prevent that group from quote-unquote propagating or actually having, you know, offspring, then that's something you certainly would do. But I think in terms of the negative connotations, I think one of the things is that when you look at terms sociologically, when you look at how in society and its institutions impact on the way people think, clearly you and I understand that the way these institutions impact on our people has a deleterious impact, a never negative impact on the way our people think, or the way our people, you know, or the kind of stress that imposed upon our people, and as a result creating the kind of maladaptive kinds of attitudes or behaviors that manifest themselves as in response to, you know, feeling oppressed. So we understand that given that reality, but we also understand that because human beings respond to the conditions, that it's only natural that human beings respond to oppressive conditions. And so that's nothing unique in terms of that. Now, even if when you look at poor white people, the situation is the same. The only difference is that when it comes to African people, the rationale has always been that somehow, you know, our response to oppression has nothing to do in terms of being human. Our response to oppression, in fact, is not even a concern, that in fact our problem is just more genetic, it's more innate, that it has nothing to do in terms of institutions. And so when you talk about institutions in the context of eugenics or Margaret Sanger movement or Planned Parenthood, it's never a question in terms of the negative impacts that society has on the impact on the way people think, the way they behave. That's never discussed. The implication is that the problem with African people is an innate one, and there's something that there's nothing they can do in terms of improving that situation other than limiting our numbers, if not outright killing African people, or certainly preventing African people from having offspring. So this is par for the course, Brother Jabari. So I don't think it's anything new in terms of this, in terms of Planned Parenthood and its proximity to African people, brown people, or indigenous people, or what have you. So I think it's just part of the course.
I raised that particular question because for those that don't know, they need to understand and be able to connect the dots, because they are very savvy in their propaganda campaign to convince people that they do something that they're actually the antithesis to. So we want to have these kind of discussions to let people know that it's okay to question things and do your own research and not necessarily be falling into what's propagated to you 24/7 every day.
Yeah. Well, that's the importance in terms of having these kind of programs and having these kind of discussions to sensitize people to the reality. But you're right, they have a very sophisticated propaganda machine, and to a large extent, a lot of African people have internalized their own self-hatred. And so, therefore, they're less likely to understand the role of institutions in terms of our impact on the way people behave, and more likely to blame the individual for the problems he or she have. So a lot of times... You hear some African people talk about the fact that the problems of African people are self-inflicted and not understanding the role of institutions in terms of facilitating or creating a lot of these problems that exist in the community. So you're absolutely correct. But again, it's going to take more and more of these kind of programs to get people to start thinking about this stuff. Otherwise, they'll become victims of propaganda, a very powerful propaganda machine.
And at this time, we will take a momentary station break, and then we will return with our discussion.
Okay.
Our discussion with our next article. Residents of Flint are being billed for poison water and threatened with shutoffs if they don't pay. It's very interesting. Yet again, we have the state of Michigan coming under scrutiny because of their policy regarding water. It wasn't that long ago there was a made international news about how the state of Michigan were charging their residents extravagant fees because of outdated water bills, yet businesses who had come up with even bigger amounts were given pardons and nothing was happening to them, but yet the people are complaining about poison water and the people saying that if you don't pay your bills, you get no water at all. What is going on? And I thought, like, Brother Anthony, to start with, what's going on in Michigan in regards to this poison water?
Okay. Well, in the case of Flint, they changed the source of their water supply from the Detroit River to the Flint River, which apparently has a lot of industrial pollution from the industries that exist in that state. And as a result, there is a heavy amount of lead contamination in the drinking water for the people that live in Flint, Michigan. Now there's an interesting tie into our previous discussion about how people's environment has an effect on health. Now, this kind of chemical contamination can have an effect on a person's physical and mental health, and you have a lot of Africans living under these conditions in this area. So I think that bears importance in terms of looking at the long term health ramifications for the people that are forced to live in that area.
Thank you, Brother Anthony. And something that I'm going to add that will tie in, and I'll ask Brother Haki to speak to how that could connect as well. As my fellow panelists know, Michigan is one of those states with emergency management law where if the government feels like he's going to be incapacitated for any period of time, he can designate any individual of his choosing to be able to run that entire state. Given you got this kind of phenomenon going on, Brother Haki, just speak to how, if they enacted the emergency manager law, how it could tie into this contaminated water situation.
Well, when you talk about these emergency management laws, one of the things that the focus of these individuals is not in terms of addressing the concerns of the community. It's about the bottom line. It's about all about profitability. One of the things, when you talk about a place like Flint, Michigan, which is predominantly African, and you talk about the socioeconomic indicators being relatively low, one of the things that when you appoint these emergency supervisors to come in, you want to create a situation not only where you actually collect money, but more importantly, you want to create a situation where those people who invest in government bonds there in Flint, you want to make sure that the environment is correct in terms of them prospering. You want to make it as profitable as possible. One of the things, as opposed to getting the water from Detroit River, as opposed to the river in Flint, one of the things you did was that not only did you effectively cut revenue, from Detroit, But more importantly, you enhance the profitability for investors who invest in water right there in Flint. Now, here's the thing. When you talk about Flint, Michigan, they are very, very clear in terms of the environmental degradation that happened to the water. For a long period of time, Flint has always been had an industrial base. And the question in terms of pollution of the water has been known for a long, long time. In fact, during the time of industrialization, back in the 60s, 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, the question of lead in the water has long been known to those in power that the water was very, very polluted. But then what happens is that when you got these people in positions of power and it's all about profitability, then the question in terms of the ill effects of lead is not important. What is more important is that people make money, you know, off of selling that water that's full of lead. And so this is the danger when you start appointing people in terms of you'll be an emergency capacity in terms of administering, you know, the policy and laws, you know, in a particular locale. So I think Flint, Michigan is a good example in terms of the kind of lunacy that exists when you start talking about money at any cost. And so the question in terms of people's lives, the value of their lives, become exceedingly unimportant. And this is what we have to understand. So this notion in terms of people with the lead poisoning and the implications for the future in terms of children not being able to read and to write, it's not important to these people because, after all, the people that we're talking about who are vastly impacted by lead in the water happen to be African people, so therefore it's not really important. But what is important is that you create a scenario in which the bondholders for the Flint bonds for the city of Flint, you want to make sure that they make as much money as possible. And so the ill health of the citizens is not important at all. And so this is what we understand. So to say that this was some kind of accident would be extremely disingenuous. It was no accident. They knew the water was contaminated with lead. They knew that long back, as far back as the 40s. They knew that. So we have to understand, have to see for what it is, and that is genocide being perpetrated against the African people in Flint, Michigan.
Allow me to add to what was said. It was in Sacramento, California, where former NBA star Kevin Johnson is the mayor. Because of them having some water issues in California, he purposely made sure that he had fresh water personally delivered to him. And I find that very interesting. That's a contradiction because here it is. He's the mayor of a particular city. He didn't say that he was going to put the well-being of the people first. He wanted to make sure that him and his family were taken care of. So it's very interesting. I'm sure Brother Hakeem will agree that this isn't probably the only state where this kind of scenario is going on.
Yeah, but there's nothing unusual about that arrangement. I mean, the problem is that those people, who pollute the water, who pollute the food, who understand the ill effects in terms of consuming, you know, poor water and poor food, they also have the food shipped to them. That's not unusual. The wealthy don't eat the same food that everybody else eats. So it's just the way it goes. But what needs to happen is that people have to first and foremost stand up and say enough is enough. I think that's the only way you can put an end to this kind of disparity when it comes to the kinds of water and the kind of food that people take in. Anything short in terms of people actually standing up and organizing, we can be sure that we have more and more of that. One of the things is that when we talk about externalities and we talk about the fact that these corporations pollute the water in which people have to drink, well, they pollute the water, they make huge sums of money, but then when you have the negative impacts in terms of people consuming the water, in terms of lead poisoning, kids' inability to learn, all kinds of diseases that proliferate, then the corporations don't pay one iota in terms of paying for the damage that they create in the first place. And so this is peculiar in terms of capitalism when we talk about externalities. And this is the thing that we have to understand, that the value of human life is not important to the capitalist class. They could care less. There's a term called shot and fraud. In other words, you got wealthy people who take great delight, who love to see the fact that so many people are suffering, so many people are catching hell, so many people are privy or are subjected to the most inferior kinds of water, the most inferior kind of food. They take great joy in that. I mean, it's so heinous that they call it shot and fraud. And this is the thing that we have to understand in terms of the mindset of a lot of very powerful people. So when you talk about someone like Mitt Romney or Karl Rove, or Donald Trump, any of these wealthy people, you know, actually taking glee the fact that the misfortune of so many people in the society, we have to understand exactly what it is. So it's incumbent upon people, you know, who were inflicted with these melodies to stand up and to organize and to fight back. And if they don't organize and fight back, then one thing we can anticipate more of the same on a much greater level. And so this is why people have to stand up and organize.
Robert, your thoughts?
Yeah, well, right now they're trying to recall that governor, I think his name is Snyder, the governor who appointed this emergency manager, who was not elected. He was not elected by anybody, was just appointed. And he decided that if he diverted the water from Detroit to Flint River, he would save money. And the Virginia Tech, some of the researchers, researchers in Virginia Tech did a study, and they determined that if they had originally, when they diverted, if they had just invested $100 a day in purification processes, it would have helped a great deal. But they didn't even do that. And so it was a profit-driven system, as all capitalism is. And it's, like you said, the people are the last thing on their mind. People don't count. It's about money. It's about power. It's about maintaining lifestyles and at the expense of the working people and the poor people of Flint. And this is the situation they're faced with today. It's lead, memory loss, all kinds of problems. Now they got Legionnaires' disease, and it's just a deplorable situation, all because somebody who wasn't even elected, and the governor who was so callous that he didn't stay on top of what was going on, or if he did, he didn't care, and so he should be recalled. Thank you.
But you know, also I think one of the things that we have to figure prominently when we talk about how these kind of discussions. We have to understand that when we talk about this whole concept in terms of neoliberalism, and we talk about the absence of government responsibility when it comes to these kind of problems, you know, impacting on human beings, one of the things that neoliberalism calls for is a lack of government accountability or lack of government participation in terms of overseeing processes that are so important to the masses of people in society. Anytime you have a system which says that, you know, that government no longer has a responsibility to its people, then in fact that responsibility is given to corporations, then you can anticipate more injustice, more suffering, more poisoning of the water and a food supply. So this is one of the problems that's peculiar in terms of capitalism. And as we go on, one of the things is neoliberalism becomes stronger and stronger, then the kind of injustices that inflict people, the kind of lack of quality water, lack of quality food becomes the norm. It's not unique. It becomes the norm. And so if anyone thinks, in fact, that, you know, government, lack of government involvement is a good thing, then I got a bridge in Brooklyn for sale. Clearly, government has a place in terms of addressing a lot of these wrongs, but as it exists currently, government doesn't play an active part in terms of innovating policy, creating policy, overseeing policy that's in the best interest of human beings, that, in fact, corporations run this show. And so, therefore, corporations is not about humanity. It's not about justice. It's not about empathy. It's all about the bottom line. And so, therefore, if you can make profit by giving people water full of lead, then so be it. And I think one of the things is the irony of all ironies is the fact that not only is the water consumed with lead, but you have the audacity to charge people exorbitant amounts of money for the right to consume lead in their water. So it speaks to the kind of neoliberalism, the kind of sickness that permeates society, and unfortunately is impacting, you know, more and more people in terms of, you know, gaining some kind of credibility in terms of, you know, government not involvement in terms of the affairs of human beings in the system. So I think that the only solution for people really is organization. But in order to organize, number one, people have to become informed. They have to make a point of wanting to know what's going on and not running from the information, but actually running to the information and start the process in terms of, you know, going to libraries, reading, try to figure out what's going on. Ask the question, what's going on? Why is it going on? Because anything short of understanding what's going on, it can only be bode well, can't bode well for the masses of people in society. So this is a peculiar problem in terms of neoliberalism, in terms of the kind of injustice inflicted upon people when you don't have government involvement in terms of government policy.
Now, I agree with you wholeheartedly, Haki, with that also, is the fact that people individually who have done appropriate studies are very suspicious about the water that's available from the municipal supply, which is why you have more and more people buying bottled water, which serves the interests of the corporations that make and distribute bottled water. And but the real solution is to get water is the demand. And that can only be done from a position of strength, demand the right to drinkable, potable water. And there's technology that is to provide that. But in order to hold governments accountable for that, the people have to be organized to demand that.
But you know, Brother Anthony, one of the ironies is that when we talk about bottled water, a lot of people don't realize it, but the FDA is under no obligation, or companies that bottle water are under no obligation, as far as the FDA is concerned, Food and Drug Administration, to actually check that water. They're under no obligation whatsoever. So as a consequence, a lot of that bottled water that you get, if you compare it to municipal water compared to bottled water, municipal water is much cleaner because the water is treated. Bottled water doesn't have to be treated, and that's what people don't understand. They think that their corporations tell them, drink this water, it's better for you, it's cleaner. But in reality, it's not cleaner. Municipal water is cleaner because it's treated. Bottled water is not, and there's no legal mandate say that you have to treat bottled water. And this is the thing that we have to understand. So when we talk about the consumption of misinformation as pertains to corporations' propaganda, then we understand that because corporations say so, doesn't make it true. So this is the real irony when we talk about bottled water. So bottled water is not as healthy as people think it is. What people think it is because corporations told them that it's healthy for you, and it's not.
Interesting point.
Does anyone else have any closing comments before we move to our next topic?
Well, interesting enough, this emergency manager, he has not been reprimanded or fired or anything. I think they moved him on now to the Detroit school system, is my understanding. He's now doing his work in the Detroit school system, is my understanding.
And what people have to understand that with this emergency manager law is after one emergency manager serves his term and situation arises, they just can continue to dictate whomever they choose, so they can keep the same person or it can be somebody else. But either way, this is clear cronyism at work, and it's definitely something that I hope in the near future can be discussed in the Supreme Court and can be struck down as unconstitutional because of the problem it creates when you talk about this kind of scenario where it's not about who's best qualified to serve the people, but it's a matter of who's going to keep corporate interests at the forefront.
Well, you know, the problem is that before you go forward, Jabari, the problem is that the thing that the people in Flint, actually in Detroit as well, have actually been challenging the emergency authority, this so-called Emergency Authority Act. They actually been challenging that, and they've been very successful. But the problem is this: there hasn't been no definitive ruling by the Supreme Court one way or the other, which means that until there's a definitive ruling by the Supreme Court, The governors are free to get rid of one emergency commissioner and replace him with another, and that's certainly legitimate and reasonable and legal. So the thing is that when we look at the conservative Supreme Court, one of the things that these people are very, very clear on, the conservative Supreme Court really believe that, in fact, this whole notion in terms of neoliberalism is something that they support. Because, in other words, because the right to prosper at all other expense is something they hold near and dear to in their hearts, and so therefore they don't have a problem philosophically in terms of people's right to exploit other folks for material gain, and so therefore when you appoint these people for the sole purpose of extracting as much wealth out of them as you possibly can, while rendering them inferior products, the Supreme Court, these conservatives on the Supreme Court don't have a problem with that at all. And so, therefore, if I were to conjecture, I would say that given the Roberts Court, that we'll find that this is the only, they would see this as an appropriate remedy in terms of the problems that the society is facing. Keep in mind, as the society continues to deteriorate, as fewer and fewer people have more and more access to the wealth, then the only recourse in terms of being able to extract revenues from poor people is to have these emergency management types who are actually in a position to better squeeze these poor people in terms of taking what little resources they have and then giving those resources to the very, very wealthy. So I think that the conservative court would agree that this kind of practice is not only desirable, but in fact legally permissible. And this is the problem that we're confronted with in terms of legality. And this is why people have to become organized, understand that, you know, that you have a right to exist, and but you have to fight for it.
And with that being said, we're going to move on to our next topic, which is dealing with people yet again having access to the basic right put in question. And the topic, and this title of this topic is Women in Baltimore Public Housing. Women in Baltimore Public Housing were forced to pay specs for basic repairs. And this comes from Bryce Covert, and this was written for thinkprogress.org. Now I ask Brother Moses to take the lead on this, and as Brother Moses comes forward, what society are we living in where those who have the least of society are forced to do prostitution like that in regards to that what they need? And with that question in mind, Brother Moses, please proceed.
Yes, one concrete example was there was a woman who had a refrigerator problem, and she could not get her refrigerator repaired or a new refrigerator, but this maintenance person, you know, made her an offer, and she held out as long as she could, I guess, and decided that she would compromise herself, and sure enough, the refrigerator showed up after she did the act, and she was just one among many. And so, you know, this is an atrocity. This is one of the worst things you can do is rape someone, this economic disparity and holding it and using it against women and other people for self gratification. This is a deplorable. This is sick. This is really, really sick. But this is what's going on in the Baltimore public housing situation. Thank you.
And you know, Brother Moses, I agree with what you just shared with us. Now you've likened it to what's going on in terms of, as we look at the political race, as we see with all these politicians, especially this year, it's become more evident for more money getting involved in races. It's amazing the number of corporate money you see as these politicians are prostitutes doing favors for people who give them the money. And yet, you know, it's amazing how this is very similar in terms of what's going on in the public housing, except the only difference is these people are forced into it and not necessarily paid to perform these acts. But as we move forward, Brother Anthony, what's your response?
I think the incidents mentioned in this article are an outstanding example of the triple exploitation that our women face. I mean, you have a group of probably very poorly paid, you know, maintenance people taking advantage of, women who do not have the means to, pack up and move away. They have to stay where they're at. And so they have no option except to, rent out their bodies in order to get basic services. And as Brother Moses alluded to, this is a sick situation. I mean, we have, people basically you know, in the same, you know, economic grouping, maybe one slightly better because they're employed, exploiting people who do not have the means to really, you know, defend themselves.
This is, and I'll have Brother Hakeem speak to this point. Something that is very telling for me is, why is it that in order to come across information of this nature, I had to go to an independent news site? This is something that, as we hear about the different instances with the big court case going on in Baltimore regarding Freddie Gray, it's very interesting that somehow this was left out of media. You don't see this anywhere. You really had to do thorough research to come across information of this nature, which is important, because it's showing you that Freddie Gray is just a tip of the iceberg in regards to corruption and just a moral activity going on in Baltimore. I'll allow Brother Haki to share his response to what's going on in Baltimore.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things is that when we talk about the male treatment of women, I think one of the things is that we understand that it's part and parcel of the American experience. We essentially see women as things to pleasure us. And one of the things that when you look at in terms of the poor economy, that inevitably when there's a poor economy, you always have the fashion for women is always shorter and shorter dresses. There's a reason why the dresses become shorter and shorter during times of economic dislocation. Well, it's because it becomes served as a kind of distraction for men in terms of being able, you know, to fixate on something other than the problems that you're confronted with. I think this kind of mentality, particularly when you talked about working class people, become more self-evident in terms of how they see women. And so therefore you got a situation in these projects where people have a particular perception of women who live in those projects and who see them as not only vulnerable, but see them as, in fact, you know, wanting to participate in the degrading kinds of behaviors. And so therefore they don't have a problem in terms of the exploitation of women sexually, because not only do they feel that they're entitled as a man, but also because the people that they are dealing with are simply not, in the fullest sense of the word, you know, totally deserving in terms of human respect. So I think it's a problem that's a societal problem. I think it's a problem that the community has to confront. But I think it's going to take a lot of self, you know, introspection, that we actually begin to look at what it is to be a man in society in terms of how we see women. And it is unfortunate that the most vulnerable, in these projects find themselves preyed upon. And in fact, if these people had any consciousness, those individuals who work in these projects, they would understand that, you know, they would feel very, very bad about taking advantage of these sisters, you know, who are the most vulnerable. But then again, in the context of capitalism, one of the things that we're conditioned to do very, very well is to prey on one another. And so, therefore, those we perceive as weak, we don't have a problem in terms of preying on them, because that, in fact, that's what capitalism is. You prey on those who are perceived as weak. Those who are somehow lacking, you prey on them. And so, therefore, clearly those women are the most vulnerable of the vulnerable, and so, therefore, you prey on them. And without any concerns, no qualms whatsoever in terms of rightness or wrongness of what you're doing. So this is the problem that we're confronted with. And so these guys who actually carry this out don't have a problem with that. And in fact, the article alludes to the fact that not only did these people do it, but they were supported by their peers who also knew what was going on, who also worked to hide it. So it's unfortunate this kind of thing happened, but this kind of thing happens all too often in terms of these projects, you know. And so one last thing, and I'm going to conclude with this, one of the things we have to understand is that historically when we look at projects, you know, projects initially were created in the 30s for the sole purpose of housing the immigration population from Europe, initially. And what happened is that during the 60s, that whole process changed, where they started building houses in the suburbs, you know, for quote-unquote white immigrants, and the projects became the domain of those who were people of color, particularly African people. And so, therefore, projects at that point began to take on a unique character in terms of people perception, in terms of projects. And so, therefore, if even from the 60s, this whole notion in terms that this is a place in which the most despised, the most powerless, the most vulnerable reside, is something that is a mindset that exists in so many people. And so, I'm not surprised that these clowns will actually take. Abuse these women sexually. It's unfortunate, but until we have more discussion in terms of, you know, why is that? Then I think this kind of thing would continue to persist. And Baltimore, by no stretch of the imagination, is atypical.
I would agree with that, and I'm pretty sure that that it was because this journalist had taken the time to do the research and write about this that we know about Baltimore, but it probably happens in every major city in the U.S. To some degree where there is, low-income public housing. And, you know, and it's unfortunate, and I think, you know, the way women are viewed in this society lends to this sort of exploitation. And, you know, the movies that come out of Hollywood are full of it. So you have a group of otherwise powerless men, exerting their frustrations on the women around them. And, it's been going on for hundreds of years. And I think the point you alluded to earlier is the root of so-called black-on-black violence. I mean, we're not organized enough to really take it to our enemies, so we lash out at the people around us. And I think that's where the so-called black-on-black crime, black-on-black violence comes from.
Right. Exactly. Very good point. Very good point. The kind of frustration, the kind of self-hatred and the self-loathing that exists in the minds of some of our people has to manifest itself. Well, of course, the way it manifests itself is not just in terms of just feeling self-hatred or self-loathing, but actually to penalize or to victimize those who are perceived as somehow lacking, or those who you perceive as powerless. And so, therefore, it is a problem. And so this is why you have to have a discussion in terms of, you know, what it is in terms of sexism in the society and how does it impact on people, particularly, as Brother Anthony alluded to, you know, working-class people who are themselves victimized by the system, in terms of how is it this victimization, how does it impact the way men think, and how does it empower them to then victimize women. And so, therefore, we have to have those discussions. And without those discussions, those men out here who feel powerless, who feel compelled to victimize women, that kind of practice will continue unabated. And so, therefore, it will come upon us, you know, to have these kind of discussions in terms of, you know, why this exists in the first place.
And the irony is these type of horrors are taking place while a black female mayor serves Baltimore, but as we know, politicians, most of them are figureheads. It's not a matter of just because there's a black face in position doesn't mean that they're necessarily looking out in the best interest of their people.
You make an interesting point. Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Brother Anthony made a good point. The triple whammy of the class or economic interest, and then there's the race situation, and then there's the sex situation. And so there's a triple whammy going on. The stock of affordable housing is very limited throughout this country. That's a real issue, affordable housing. Then the income itself is you know, if you're a people of color, you're the last hired and the first fired, and you're never getting any decent wages even when you are hired. And so it's a very, very deplorable situation that these women are in and the people of color in general. Thank you. Go ahead, Anthony.
No, I was going to add that I think these articles show that having an African in a high political position does not improve the conditions of the masses of African people, not by any stretch. As a matter of fact, because of the mindset of those in high positions, the conditions of the masses of African people have gotten worse over the years, not better. And so I think one of the important things to keep in mind that visibility does not equal power. And that was one of Kwame Ture's many lessons that he shared with us during the course of his life. that black visibility is not black power. And I think that these years that Obama's been in office clearly show that.
And on that note, as we have around, this is the final 20 minutes, before we do our closing, we know that recently we had the State of the Union, so I just want you all to take back if you, in response to the State of the Union address. I saw you, Brother Anthony.
The State of the Union address that Obama gave recently?
Yeah, your response to it.
Okay. One is the fact that that he catered to the European ruling class interests primarily, and he was successful in that regard. I think in terms of what the masses of African people wanted from him, he was a huge disappointment. But I'm not going to entirely blame that on him. I think it was a consequence of the fact that he was that he's a member of the Democratic Party. And in order to be a member of the Democratic Party, you have to toe their political line and program. And that's the rule of any political parties. And I think the most important lesson we can draw from that is that the Democratic Party does not care about African people at all, or the American Indian people, for that matter, and that we have, and that if we want a leadership that's accountable to us, we have to select our own leadership. It has to come from the masses of the people. We cannot count on the ruling class party to represent our interests. It hasn't worked in 200 years, and it's not going to work in the future.
Brother Hakeem, your response?
Well, listen, I'm very, very candid about this. One of the things is that, you know, I didn't listen to it. I have to be very, very candid about that. Because the kind of things that he would say, I would expect him to say. Nothing he say has any real legitimacy. It's not objective. It's not honest. It's not constructive. So I wouldn't listen to it. Having said that, you know, I'll conclude with that.
Brother Moses.
Right. I'm with Haki on this one. I didn't listen to it. I don't feel like hearing a bunch of psycho babble. Basically, he highlighted, you know, the real accomplishments that he did, which Iran situation, he helped in that somewhat, and the Cuban situation, he helped in that somewhat. But really, overall, I mean, it was just regurgitated bull, as they say. Like I said, he's for the TPP. He's a capitalist. He's sold out a long time ago, and he hasn't changed. He's a liberal, and he has his neoliberal agenda, and it's time to move on. Thank you.
Yeah, but you know, the whole thing is that we have to understand that, you know, one of the things is that someone talked earlier about the fact that the president is a figurehead, and that's precisely what he is. He represents the ruling class. That's who he represents. He represents big business. He represents corporate interests. And so, therefore, nothing he can say or nothing he can articulate has any real relevance to the masses of the people in society, because the masses of the people in society don't have access to large sums of capital. And so, therefore, nothing he says is going to be of any real benefit for them. The only reason Obama was selected was because those in power understood that to have that brown face in a position of quote-unquote power, he could get away with much more oppressive measures, much more oppressive policy, without being questioned. Now, if he'd been white and come up with a lot of the kind of policies, particularly acquiesce, you know, to power, to corporations, particularly when he does all kinds of things that are unconstitutional in terms of spying on people, extrajudicial killing of U.S. citizens, targeting U.S. citizens around the world simply because you don't like what they say, If he had been white, then there'd been some cries from people out there, in who would say that those kind of things are clearly wrong. They are in opposition to the Constitution, that they're criminal, and that they're simply wrong. But, well, he's brown, so he could get away with that. So you have, by him becoming being selected president, he effectively co-opted the African community, who refuses to critique him, with the exception of Cornel West, who refuses to critique him, even though what he did is clearly is opposition to the interests of African people and of poor people, you know, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. And so, therefore, we have to understand that because he's a figurehead, that anything he said is not going to have, is not going to be germane to the masses of folks. What do you think he can do? They're going to tell you the truth? Well, remember, keep in mind, it was Obama himself who said that when one of his supporters asked him why hasn't he moved more to the left, even though when he ran for office he promised to move to the left, why haven't he done it? Obama's response was, do you remember John F. Kennedy? Well, clearly, Obama's saying to the people that, listen, if I try to move to the left, they will kill me. He's right. The power structure would kill him. The man is not a revolutionary. He's a politician. So I don't expect him to critique the society. I don't expect him to expose the society what it is. I don't expect him to innovate policies that's going to empower the masses of the people in this country. I don't expect him to do that. So as a consequence, I don't expect him to say a damn thing when it comes to State of the Union, other than the usual mealy-mouth kinds of stuff that politicians say when they acquiesce to the powerful.
Well, my response to the State of the Union was that I, too, have a high level of disdain and dissatisfaction in regard to the rhetoric that was spewed, but the point I was trying to get conveyed is that what does it mean when you have a person in this position that this is how his legacy when he leaves, this is how he presents himself, where he basically presents himself as someone that's complacent, someone that's defeated, because there's so many core issues that were relevant that could have been touched, that could have been spoken on as he's on his way out. But yet he chooses to basically, you know, do the great compromise of 2016, if you're familiar with that, so my infamous speech, and like if you were just basically with the great compromise of 2016. It is very interesting we'll do this in front of, you know, masses of people, and it just shows you the kind of ideological battles that we're going to have to deal with, where everybody that looks like us isn't our friend, and we can't get caught up in the glitz and glamour and personality of a celebrity of his magnitude, because it's more to how they got to that particular position. Because we live in a time where a lot of times your bliss and glamour is determined on certain conditions being met.
That's true, Jabari. But you know, how many people actually critique the society? How many people actually deconstruct what goes on in society? How many people really understand what goes on in society? I mean, people are constantly getting a daily dose of BS. And so, therefore, they perceive the system working one way, when in reality it works a totally different way. People who think that somehow the policies of the government is good for the policy for the masses of people. People don't understand because people are not in a position to even critique what's going on. And until you create a situation where people can deconstruct and understand, when we talk about, you know, presidential policy, and begin to look at the presidential policies and ask themselves, how is this policy going to benefit me? Then until they get to that point, then they simply are more comfortable with accepting whatever the status quo tells them is the correct thing to accept or the correct thing to believe. So therefore, it's a lot of political work that has to take place in terms of making sure people in society, particularly, you know, are working class people, before they come to the realization, you know, that a lot of things that they've been conditioned to believe is not true at all. And one of the biggest problems is that people continue to vote against their self-interest. Now, people can only vote against their self-interest when they are seriously misinformed, when they really don't know any better. Of course, we understand the role in terms of racism, in terms of, you know, people voting against their own self-interest out of racism. But also the question in terms of class. Why is it that people, poor people, why is it they continue to vote for politicians who care less about their concerns? We talk about massive unemployment, massive incarceration, massive homelessness, massive joblessness. We talk about all these problems, but these people, these same people who complain about these problems, turn right around and vote for people who exacerbate the problems of unemployment, homelessness, massive incarceration, and so forth and so on. So how do you get people to concretely begin to understand what it is in terms of political policy in this country, and how does it How does it impact me? That's a very difficult question. And so without political education, we can't even get people to a level to be even getting to deconstruct it, to even critique what's going on in society. And this is the problem. So and these problems are proliferating.
That is why, you know, those independent African organizations that exist down here, they must create political education programs for our people. Whatever forms that take, it can take a variety of forms, but we have to educate ourselves. The mouthpieces of capitalism are not going to, you know, critique themselves. They're not. And it would be crazy to expect them to do so. Only those who are against the system have to provide the guidance to another way. And there is an alternative. But because the media and the educational system are in control of the ruling bourgeoisie, most people in the U.S. don't know that another way of life is possible. Another economic system is possible. That is why the U.S. is so opposed to countries that try to create a different economic system. And
well, you know,
marginalized and put to the first step, right?
But, you know, one of those, Brother Anthony, one of the things is that they got people in power. Some of them do have a consciousness, and they do leak information. Recently we had a guy who used to work, who retired from the Federal Reserve in Dallas, Texas. And he talked about the fact that there's no wealth being created. That what's happening is that you have the Federal Reserve, buying government treasury bonds. It gives the impression that actually the overall economy is improving, when in fact the economy is not improving at all, but it gives the impression that the economy is improving. And so therefore, so when we talk about money supply and we talk about in terms of the real benefits in terms of the money supply as it relates to employment, the numbers that they give for employment are not real because, number one, the money that you're talking about doesn't really exist. It only exists on paper. And so he actually talked about that. He called it front-loading the economy. And he actually talked about that. It's akin to Janet Yellen in terms of, you know, interest rates, those so-called interest rate increases. It's the same smoke and mirrors. It's all a Ponzi scheme. And so now and then we do have wealthy people who actually come forward because they realize that ultimately this thing is not going to end up good for anybody. We talk about wholesale destruction of people. People in this country haven't seen nothing yet. You wait 5-10 years, this country, the system's going to show you something. You're talking about you're afraid now, you talk about everything is cool. Well, you wait 5 or 10 years and you begin to see as things continue to unravel very, very clearly for all to see. A lot of people are going to have to die in the society. A lot of people are going to have to pay the price of society because of the ignorance that exists. But I just want to be clear, though. There are people in positions of power who leak information all the time. One of the reasons why I know that for TV screens over 18 inches, they got a V-chip, which it gives the government the opportunity to look right into your house. While you're watching TV, they look into your house right through that TV. It's because someone leaked that information years ago. And that's the only reason people know that information exists now, because someone who innovated the technology leaked it because they weren't comfortable with that kind of spying. So there are people who positions of power who realize what's going on is fundamentally wrong. And not only that is very, very dangerous. So people do leak information. But it doesn't negate the fact that people, the masses of folks, have to become organized, have to become interested, have to become engaged in deconstructing what's going on in society to better understand what the society is all about.
I agree wholeheartedly. Unfortunately, because of the individualism that exists in a society, it seems that people only concern when the violence is right at their doorstep. I mean, the families of a Trayvon Martin, a Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, etc. But we have to get to the level where we care, regardless of whether it's is a biological family if I remember or not.
And well, We have 5 minutes remaining, and just as we concluded with our discussion response to State of the Union, we provided a point of view you often don't get on your mainstream media, and we have to move proud of ourselves from doing this because we want to create a situation where people are free to be open-minded and express different perspectives. Whether you agree or disagree with what we convey, we just ask that you come with an informed opinion and not necessarily just some fuck about because you're following the personality, just as we do. Understand that we're not here. We don't have any kind of endorsement by anybody from the mainstream media. We're offering an alternative to that which you get on a daily basis so that you can be a free thinker and challenge things and understand that a bright tomorrow is possible, but it's a matter of getting with like-minded people and organization is key. And as time runs out with our final 5 minutes, I'd like for Song with Brother Anthony to make a closing statement.
Certainly. I would say to all people who are not in an organization, join a political organization that's working for your people's liberation and study our history and the events, current events that are happening around us with an open mind.
Thank you, Brother Haki.
Yeah, I think one of the things, you know, I would just admonish people, you know, to be very, very concerned about the kind of changes that are taking place in society. One of the things is that often people think that we engage in hyperbole. When we sit there and we tell you these things that are going on, it's not based upon conjecture, it's not based upon guess, it's not based upon surmise. It's based upon, you know, concrete study, concrete research in terms of what's going on. And the kind of research that we're talking about comes from multiple sources. So anything that we say can always be checked upon. So it's important that people understand, you know, the kind of changes that are going on in society has very, very poor implications, very negative implications for their existence, for the longevity in society. And so we got a fundamental question to ask ourselves. What do we do in the context of so much change, which is so negative? What do we do? Well, we don't have but one or two choices. Samuel Beckett's book, The Choice, so here's your two choices. One, you can stand up and fight back, or two, you can do nothing and die. Those are your choices. You got to decide which side of that equation you're falling on. Nothing short of understanding what's going on is going to be of any real value, because the bottom line is that the people who, the capitalist class, those positions of power, are committed to enhancing their power, and that means that the demoralization or the humiliation of the masses of people has to go on unabated. And so, therefore, they're committed to that stand. And so, therefore, it's incumbent upon the people to stand up and to understand that you are somebody. And by virtue of your humanity, you have a right to exist and be willing to fight for that. Thanks.
Brother Moses?
Yeah, I'd like to say it's been wonderful for sure. They're very insightful. I think we have to agree to disagree on Planned Parenthood, though. I think self-determination and science has to be used in the public interest, and I don't know what might meant for evil can be used for good, but we as a people have to get organized. We have to be conscious. We have to study, and we have to deal with this oppressive system realistically by overthrowing it to an organization, which a party is the only way out. Thank you.
This concludes this week's Africa on the Move. And as the other panelists have stated, we appreciate the support of those who listen to us. And make sure you tell others to tune in next week, because we'll have another insightful program. And make sure to do your own research and not to...
I wanna love you and treat you right. I wanna love you every day and